not used to a microphone. I'm normally so loud without acoustics. Hi, my name is Kate, and I, like Robert said, thank you for the wonderful introduction. I'm a Connecticut lifer from Manchester, born and raised and living there still today. I first got interested in World War I when I was a little girl, and my grandmother took me to see Bon Voyage Charlie Brown. And there's a lovely little scene where Snoopy goes to a little cafe and starts drinking what I think children are supposed to think is root beer, but I'm pretty sure it was some kind of ale, and lamenting, hearing sad, sad songs of Paris and of France. And I was a huge Snoopy fan, so this kind of caught my eye in his little, in his khaki uniform. And then shortly after that, I received a little record for Christmas of The Flight of the Red Baron, and then I was completely hooked on all things World War I. So thank you, Snoopy, for my lifelong love of war poetry and of the study of this war, which I think is kind of the turning point for our civilization as human beings. I think that it's where the line skewed and where we kind of went, we might have gone in a different direction, and instead we went where we are today. So this is Wilfred Owen. This is probably one of the most famous pictures of him. This book you can get through interlibrary loan, you know, at any of the state libraries. So, Wilfred Owen is the second most studied poet in Britain. He's second only to William Shakespeare. Owen reinvented war poetry, and there's a really strong case to suggest that he reinvented modern poetry. His verse is angry, arresting, vivid, and raw. It's more vivid than any war reporting of the day, and some might argue any war reporting in history. Owen was born in the spring of 1883 in Austria Street, a rural village in Shropshire. It's just about 3 miles from the Welsh border. So Owen had a lot of Welsh influences. He kind of likened himself to be Welsh rather than English. His father's ancestry went back to Wales. And he was really interested in all the epic poems of Welsh heroes and all of the epic poems and songs of Welsh history. His parents were Tom and Susan Owen. He's the eldest of four children, brothers Harold and Colin and sister Mary. The family lived in a comfortable, large country house built by his maternal grandfather. So his family, you know, a few generations back, picture like the Austens. They were in a English estate. They weren't terribly wealthy, but they were pretty comfortable. Around the turn of the century, the family fell in hard times, and they had to sell the house and all their possessions to move to a more modern home in industrial Birkenhead. All of this intensified Owen's already strong bond with his mother. Susan was a strong but domineering woman. She was highly ambitious and pinned all her hopes and dreams on her eldest son. Owen loved his mother's attention. When he was away from her, even for a short time, like on a camping trip or visiting relatives, he would write her little cards, like little postcards, and tell her everything he did and everything he saw. And they're extremely sophisticated, and the penmanship is outstanding for a five-year-old. It really is quite extraordinary. He was devoted to her, and she was devoted to him. There are over 500 surviving letters between the two, ranging from cards sent at age 5 until his final letters, which arrived a week after his death in 1918 on the Western Front. By the time Owen was 11, he had become a rather bookish boy. He was in love with Keats and Shakespeare. His early attempts at poetry were pretty mediocre at best, and that's being kind. They were pretty bad. But he persisted on. He was determined to become a writer. In Edwardian England, education was only provided up until the age of 12. Most young people either went into factory work, cottage work, or apprenticeship. Owen was not a member of the elite 1% of the upper class who were assumed to go to university. He did manage, however, to get a spot at London University, part-time via correspondence. So think of him as being going to the University of Phoenix, you know, in this kind of turn of the century world. He realized, though, that if he wanted to keep writing and become a poet, he needed to work and he needed to earn a living. So while he was struggling in school, he took a position as a vicar's assistant. His mother, who was very, very religious, was thrilled. He spent 2 years, from the age of 18 to the age of 20, in Dunstan, which is near Reading. as a vicar's assistant. In a letter to his mother, he summed up his days: "My life is filled with sitting in uncomfortable chairs with uncomfortable people in uncomfortable cottages." The vicar was by no means a wealthy man, but he was considerably more comfortable than the parishioners that he served. The stark contrast between the vicar and the villagers really affected Owen. The village was impoverished. Most of the villagers lived in small one-room cottages with dirt floors, with no running water, a lot of times little clusters of cottages, sometimes up to a dozen, would share one well. Infant mortality and child mortality was extremely high. Most of the people couldn't afford any kind of health care and couldn't possibly get to London to be treated. And at this time, London Hospital was really flourishing and really open and interested in taking care of rural populations like this, but they couldn't get as far as Reading. So these villagers didn't receive a lot of the social care that was sweeping through London. So this division of wealth, the disease that flourished among his parishioners, the quality of life, it eroded Owen's faith in God and the church. In 1913, much to his mother's dismay, he left Dunstan. He hadn't fulfilled his mother's dreams for him. He lost his faith and missed the last set of exams for university. So without much of a clue of what he was doing with his life, he did what many of his generation did in 1913. He went abroad to find himself, which I think we'd all love to have done. I still would like to do that at 37. I want to go wander France and find myself. So he settled on France, Bordeaux to be specific. There he taught English to young students, and it was the first time that he was really free and independent. I can really relate to this. The first time my first apartment, that first time when you're out on your own and you're 20, you know, you feel like you're invincible. So while he's away, he took up smoking and drinking wine. He stopped going to church, but all the while, he was still writing to his mother on a regular basis. This idyllic, kind of carefree life came to an abrupt end on July 28, 1914. And that is when the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand occurred. So during this time and the time leading up, I'm just gonna do really quick World War I kind of blurb, because this really, we wanna talk about Owen. So Europe was in a relatively long span of peace. It was about a 50-year period where there was no great conflict, but they were prepared for war. Very few appreciated that war at this time would become prolonged and worldwide, and the advances in technology and especially chemistry would possess the most unseen horrors and human destruction that they'd ever seen. A lot of people refer to World War I as the Chemist War because of the use of poisonous gas, which features very heavily in Owen's poems. In general, World War I is seen as a war of attrition. Each side just kept fighting and fighting and trying to wait out the other side. The year 1916, which is the year after Owen enlisted, is sometimes referred to as the year of the slaughter. From July 1st till November 18th, Great Britain, France, and Germany were entrenched in some of the longest, bloodiest battles in military history, the Battle of the Somme especially. On the first day, Great Britain counted as many as 60,000 casualties, one-third of them fatal. Overall, when the fighting finally stopped in the autumn of 1916, Great Britain suffered 409,000 casualties. So this kind of brought the idea that this war is going to be over really fast, and this optimist that Europe will prevail, it just kind of brought it to a crashing end. And people started to think that it was going to be a complete failure. So this experience in Europe of war, that it led to a collective trauma that was felt by all the participating countries. The Western Front, which is where Owen fought, was very conducive to poetry. And this kind of collective mourning and this collective trauma led to what's referred to as trench art, which would be if soldiers would create art from whatever they could find. They would carve things into bullets, carve loose pieces of wood, make clay from the mud in the trenches, and poetry. Poetry was probably one of the more easy ones to do, because you could write on the back of letters, on the back of envelopes, on scraps of paper, you know, pretty much anything you could find. And where Owen was, like I said, was really conducive to poetry. Many of the soldiers themselves were in stalemates, paralyzed in these trenches, and the poems were easy to come by and easy to preserve. The diversity in this writing is really astounding. Owen, among many other poets, really, really thrived. So back to Owen's military career. In September of 1915, Owen returned to England from France and signed on to the Artist's Rifle on October 20th. So there were whole regiments of the army that were dedicated to artists. So if you could be part of a battalion full of painters and full of poets and full of writers, and they were carpentry battalions and plumbing battalions and steelworking battalions. So they kind of kept people together by their trade. By now he convinced himself that he had to fight. He thought that only by fighting would he be able to save the language of Keats and Shakespeare. He had developed a fear that a German victory would destroy the English language and culture. At the time that he enlisted, he actually failed to meet the height requirement. He was about 5'4¾", I think it said, so we'll call him 5'5", we'll give him an extra inch. But in 1915, they decide a lot of the war records were kind of fudged, like, okay, you don't quite meet the height requirement, we're gonna give you a couple pounds, or you didn't quite get to the 5'5", so we're gonna call you 5'5". At this point, they're taking anybody they can. By the end of the war, in Germany, they were enlisting men and women as young as 12 to fill the ranks. So in June of 1916, he received his commission in the 5th Battalion of the Manchester Regiment and spent the rest of the year training. He wasn't too fond of his battalion at first. He thought that the boys from Manchester were rough, uncultured, and uncouth. He did manage to gain a lot of respect from his men, as he proved to be an excellent shot with all of his infantry weapons. It's a really curious combination, don't you think, of somebody that desires to be a poet and who is absolutely lethal with a rifle, a machine gun, and a pistol. Owen arrived in France with his battalion on December 30th, where he wrote to his mother that he was in perfect spirits. What he neglected to mention in this letter is that at this point in the war, the life expectancy of an officer was measured in weeks and sometimes days. His first taste of battle came in January of 1917, when he and his men had to hold out for about 50 hours in a flooded dugout in no man's land, while being heavily bombarded with German artillery. This position basically now is one of the largest cemeteries for World War I veterans. Owen simply referred to the area as a sad land. His time in the dugout undoubtedly changed Owen. From his training, his idea of war started to erode, kind of like when he was in the church. Once he actually saw what he had to do and saw what was going on, his idea really changed. In one of his poems, The Sentry, which we'll read, is a really direct account, is a true account of his time in the dugout, and something that he kind of wrestled with for the rest of his life. He blamed himself for the death of one of his men. In March of 1917, he received what was seen as a minor injury falling into a cellar back from the front line. And he was only kind of out of it for a couple weeks. In May, he was hit by a small shell at Savoie Blanc and was spent several days in a railway embankment. And this explosion killed one of his friends called Cock Robin, which is his nickname. The reason this is so devastating is that he spent several days trapped in a railway embankment. That sounds like he might have been holed up, you know, in a dugout, kind of. It really is quite a lot more. Robin was one of his friends. Several authors have speculated that they might have been lovers. Either way, it was somebody that he really cared for, and Robin was literally blown to pieces, and Owen was trapped under those pieces for days, which is just a horror that I don't think anyone should ever endure. Not only was the physical toll of his injury, but being surrounded by the remains of somebody that he really, really cared about. So not surprisingly, shortly after this, he was diagnosed with shell shock, which is what we would refer to as PTSD. which they also sometimes call battle fatigue. That stuck for a long time, that battle fatigue label. Some hospitals at this time used electric shock therapy to treat shell shock. The hospital where Owen was sent, Craig Lockhart in Scotland, did not. They believed in occupational therapy. The men gardened, they looked after animals, they read, they wrote. The head doctor, Brock, encouraged Owen to write. He became the editor of the hospital's only magazine, The Hydra. Brock wanted Owen to rediscover his creativity. And at the time, several of the doctors and nurses introduced him to who would become one of his greatest friends and one of his greatest colleagues, Siegfried Sassoon. Sassoon is a great war poet in and of himself. He would read Owen's poetry and encouraged him to continue with it. While he was convalescing, he wrote most of his poems. The one that he's probably most famous for is Anthem for Doomed Youth, which we'll read in a moment, which has a heavy influence from Sassoon. There's original manuscripts where you see Sassoon's edits, which he would always preface with SS under it so that he would know that it was him that was doing the editing. So this relationship just fundamentally changed both men. Unfortunately, he couldn't stay there forever, and the war still raged on. So in the spring of 1918, Owen was released. This was shortly after he released his only book of poems. The preface of this book starts, "This book is not about heroes." And the preface continues, "My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity. The poems in this collection are blunt and told about warfare as it was, not sparing the reader nor glossing over any of the nastiest parts of the war that Owen had observed." At this time, this was the only published work, and it was in a very limited publication. His work would later be published in the 1960s by another war poet named Edmund Blunden. So Owen actually never saw his work, you know, be published. He saw a few poems here and there were published, but he really didn't get to see any success from his writing. So in June of 1918, Owen was fit to rejoin his regiment, and in August, as the war kept moving on, he was sent back to France. During this time, he was rewarded the Military Cross for bravery while in action. His citation read, "For copious gallantry and devotion to duty in the attack." And I feel like this, just that first line there, is really in contrast to what Owen really believed. He didn't believe in the gallantry and devotion of dying for one's country. Yet, unfortunately, that is exactly what he did. He did die for his country. Owen was killed on November 4th, 1918, while leading his men into battle. His unit had been ordered to cross a canal and engage the enemy. He'd been told that there should be no retreatment under any circumstances. His unit tried to cross a canal in Cork pontoons, and they were cut to pieces by machine gun fire. His parents received the news of his death on November 11th, 1918. Supposedly, the story goes that the messenger who was delivering the message couldn't get to the Owens residence by bicycle because of the parades for Armistice Day. So while their village was celebrating Armistice Day, the Owenses found out that they had lost their son, which is just, you know, absurdly tragic. So that's Wilfred Owen. He had a short life, but luckily he's still with us in his poems. So the first poem that I'm gonna read was published in Hydra, and when it was published, he dedicated the poem to a woman named Jessie Pope. Jessie Pope was also a poet. She was called a jingoist, so her poems were not quite as raw and not quite as real as Owen's poem. She wrote war poetry for the Daily Mail that encouraged enlistment. She encouraged women and men and children to hand out white feathers to people, to, you know, men who are. So here's an example. This is really the poem that is in Owen's poem that I'm going to read now. This is what he was responding to. "Who's for the trench? Are you, my laddie? Who'll follow French? Will you, my laddie? Who's fretting to begin? Who's going to win? And who wants to save his skin? Do you, my laddie? Who's for the khaki suit? Are you, my laddie? Who longs to charge and shoot? Do you, my laddie? Who's keen on getting fit? Who means to show his grit? Who'd rather wait a bit? Would you, my laddie? Who'll earn the Empire's thanks? Will you, my laddie? Who'll swell the victor's ranks? Will you, my laddie? When the procession comes, banners and rolling drums, who'll stand and bite his thumbs? Will you, my laddie? So that's a pretty pervasive poem. It's, you know, basically hearing that poem and seeing women hand out white feathers to young men would be a pretty chilling thing to see. So in Hydra, this is the poem that Owen wrote, and it was dedicated to Jesse Pope. Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstretched five nines that dropped behind. Gas, gas, quick boys, an ecstasy of fumbling. Fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone was still yelling out and stumbling. The floundering like a man in a fire or lime, dim through the misty panes of thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil sick of sin, if you could hear every jolt, the blood come curdling from froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, would you not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori? So that is an example of Owen's poem. So first, let's talk about the name of the poem, is Dulce et Decorum Est. And this is in reference to a poem, an epic poem by Horace. And I have a brief translation by John Coddington, who's one of the most famous translators of ancient Greek. And this is the relevant passage. So this is the poem that people were, that he's referring to, that people like Jesse Pope would refer to in trying to get people to enlist. To suffer hardness with good cheer in sternest school of warfare bred, our youth should learn, let steed and spear make him one day the Parthians dread. Cold skies, keen perils brace his life. Methinks I see from a rampart tower some battling tyrant's matron wife, some maiden look down in terror. Oh, my dear lord, entrained in war, oh, tempt not the infuriate mood of the fell lion I see, for far he plunges through the tide of blood. What joy for fatherland to die. Death darts even flying feet o'ertake. No, spare reluctant chivalry, a back to cowers or lions that quake. So it basically means, dulce et decorum est is, it is right and just. And pro patria mori means to die for your fatherland, for your country. So this basically means it is right and just to die for one's country. And the irony of this is that this poem is just dripping with accusation and rage, but that's exactly what Owen did. So this idea of him as this perfect shot, he was lethal and deadly with a weapon, but absolutely hated war and hated everything that war had stood for. Another poem that we'll read. This poem, I think, reflects really well what he went through at Craig Lockhart. This is, again, addressed to the people at home, people like Jesse Pope, who didn't understand quite what this war was about and what this war meant. While he was at Craig Lockhart, there was a myriad of injuries, and many people like him who were suffering from shell shock, as they called it. And this poem is about a young man that he had observed in the gardens at Craig Lockhart. It's called Disabled. He sat in a wheelchair waiting for dark and shivered in his ghastly suit of gray, legless, sewn short at the knee. Through the parked voices of boys rang saddened like a hymn, voices of play and pleasure after day till gathering sleep had mothered them from him. But this time, town used to swing so gray, when glow lamps budded in the light blue trees, and girls glanced lovelier as their air grew dim. In the old times, before he threw away his knees, he will never feel again how slim girls' waists are, or how warm their supple hands, and all of them touch him like some queer disease. There was an artist silly for his face, for it was younger than his youth last year. Now he is old. His back will never brace. He lost his color very far from here, poured it down shell holes till the veins ran dry. And half his life lapsed in hot race and leap of purple spurts from his thigh. One time, he liked a blood smear down his leg after the matches carried shoulder high. It was after football when he'd drunk a peg. He thought he'd better join. He wonders why. Someone had said he looked good in kilts. That's why. And maybe, too, to please his Meg. Aye, that was it. To please the giddy jilts, he asked to join. He didn't have to beg. Smilingly wrote his lie, age 19 years. Germans he scarcely thought of. All of their guilt and Austria's did not move him. And no fears of fear came yet. He thought of jeweled hilts for daggers and plaid socks, of smart salutes and care of arms, and leave and pay arrears. Esprit de corps and hints of young recruits, and soon he was drafted out with drums and cheers. Some cheered him home, but not as crowds cheer goal. Only a solemn man who brought him fruits thanked him and then inquired about his soul. Now he will spend a few sick years in institutes and do what things the rules consider wise and take whatever pity they may dole. Tonight he noticed how the women's eyes passed from him to strong men that were whole. How cold and late it is. Why do they come and put me into bed? Why don't they come? So Owen ends this poem without any notion of national gratitude. The soldier is alone and just and cold. It's probably one of his most bleak poems, and I think it's something that he saw happen quite often. And I think a lot of veterans can probably relate to this, that there isn't often a ticker tape parade when soldiers come home, and especially for World War I, soldiers coming home in England, a lot of the disfigurement was hidden, and the soldiers weren't really given the grand welcome home that many other soldiers, like in this poem, the men who were still whole. So right now I'm actually going to read a poem by Siegfried Sassoon. And this is, one of Owen's greatest friends and greatest colleagues. And I think it fits well after reading this poem by Owen. Owen's poems defy form. They defy what we normally think of as great English poetry, especially in the turn of the 19th century. And Siegfried Sassoon kind of embraced form and turned it on its head and modernized it. So this poem is called Suicide in the Trenches by Siegfried Sassoon. I knew a simple soldier boy who grinned at life and empty joy, slept soundly through the lonesome dark, and whistled early with the lark. In winter trenches, cowed and glum, with clumps of ice and lack of rum, he put a bullet in his brain. No one spoke of him again. You smug-faced crowds with kindling eye who cheer when soldier lads march by, sneak home and pray you'll never know the hell where youth and laughter go. That poem really doesn't need any explanation. It's one of the most powerful pieces of poetry that I've ever read and has always stuck with me for a long time. So this is the poet that had the greatest influence on Owen. And one of his most famous poems, probably second to Dulce et Decorum Est, is called Anthem for Doomed Youth. Originally, the poem was called Anthem for Dead Youth, and it was changed to Doomed Youth by Sassoon. He did a lot of little revisions on this poem and kind of led Owen to more powerful, less passive verses. So we'll read this one for you. Anthem for Doomed Youth. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns, only the stuttering rifle's rapid rattle can parrot out their hasty orisons. No mockeries for them, no prayers, no bells, nor any voice of mourning save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells, the bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them along? Not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes shall shine the holy glimmer of goodbye. The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall, their flowers, the tenderness of patient minds, and each slow at dusk drawing down of blinds. So we're gonna end with one of Owen's, it's kind of a meaty poem, it's a little esoteric, so stick with me. This is called Strange Meeting. It seemed that out of battle I escaped down some profound dull tunnel long since scooped through granite which titanic wars had groined. Yet also their encumbered sleepers groaned too fast in thought or death to be bestirred. Then as I probed them, one sprang up and stared with piteous recognition in my fixed eyes, lifting distressful hands as if to bless. And by his smile, I knew that sullen hall. By his dead smile, I knew we stood in hell. With a thousand pains that vision's face withgrained, yet no blood reached there from the upper ground, and no guns thumped, or down the flues made moan. Strange friend, I said, here's no cause to mourn. None, said the other, save the undone years, the hopelessness. Whatever hope is yours was my life also. I went hunting wild after the wildest beauty in the world, which lies not calm in eyes or braided hair, but mocks the steady running of the hour, and if it grieves, grieves richlier than here. For of my glee might many men have laughed, and of my weeping something had been left, which must die now. I mean the truth untold, the pity of war, the pity war distilled. Now men would go content with what we spoiled, or discontent, boiled bloody and bespilled. They will be swift with the swiftness of the tigress. Now we'll break ranks, though nations trek from progress. Courage was mine, and I had mastery. Wisdom was mine, and I had mystery. To miss the march of this retreating world into vain citadels that are not walled, then much blood had clogged their chariot wheels. I would go up and wash them from sweet wells, even with truths that lie too deep for taint. I would have poured my spirit without saint. But through wounds, not on the cess of war, foreheads of men have bled where no wounds were. I am the enemy you killed, my friend, I knew you in this dark, for you frowned yesterday through me as you jabbed and killed. I parried, but my hands were loathed and cold. Let us sleep now. So, if you think about a lot of the poems that were coming out of the home front in England, you have poets like Jesse Pope, or you have poets like Gerald McCraig who are writing about picking up arms to continue the fight. Owen's response to this is to read a poem from the perspective of the enemy that he killed. So I think that alone, I think, gives him a definite charge for being one of the early modernist poets. He really changed modern poetry. He defied form. He defied war poetry in general. And I think we have a lot to thank for Owen.